Welcome to The Science Line. I'm Scott.
And I'm Risa. We're here to learn about the science that's happening here in our Idaho community, but we're also challenging scientists who dare to come on our show to think about how they communicate their research to people who know nothing about it, but whose tax dollars are funding it, like us.
But we're not going to take it easy on our guests. They will have to pay for their communication faux pas, like using ridiculous and unrelatable science terms and jargon, and they better not bore us. Based on how well they do, we'll assign them written homework in the form of lines. Hopefully, this will remind them of their blunders and what not to do next time.
Geez, take it easy, Scott. No one's going to want to come on our show if you keep carrying on like that. So anyway, Scott, what topic are we kicking the show off with this week?
Well, I was recently talking to a friend about how COVID-19 has impacted schools and how many children have been forced to study at home.
I know, it's crazy how many parents have had to learn to be teachers.
Yeah, exactly. And it got me thinking about how we teach our children and young people and how our own beliefs and cultures may actually influence how we choose to do that.
Yeah, that's a really good thought because, you know, in schools, teachers have training and teaching methods and they have a kind of a syllabus that they have to follow. But parents are really having to find their own way with obviously some instruction from the schools, but there's a heavy load on the parents.
Yeah, and that can't be easy. But what I really want to talk about today is how epistemological orientation can impact how we teach our young people.
That sounds like a lot of technical language, Scott, and aren't we supposed to be avoiding that here on The Science Line?
Yeah, you're right. But epistemological orientation is basically just how we see the world, how we contextualize it, and how we engage with it.
Oh, I see what you mean. So you're thinking about how people from different cultures, religions, and backgrounds may have different ways of viewing the world, and how that will be reflected in their values and shape how and what they might teach their kids.
Yeah, exactly. And many people might not even consciously realize it or even have given it much thought. But our own beliefs are definitely going to be filtering down to our children. And this can happen through such simple things as the types of books we choose to give them.
Okay, I kind of sense a story coming on, Scott.
Yeah, so I found a really interesting scientific article on children's books, which explains that children, even preschool-aged children, can learn scientific information and vocab from their books and actually apply it to their real life. But have you ever considered which books a parent might choose to give to their child?
You know, that's really interesting to think about, Scott, and I think I see where you're going with this. So are you about to say that a person's background may influence the types of books they may give to their children?
Yeah, exactly. So in the article, it explained that Native Americans are more likely to buy books from Native American authors, and the same with non-Native Americans. Now, that might seem really obvious, but it's actually something we might not consider consciously. But it starts to get really interesting when you consider how cultural ideas are communicated within children's books.
Oh, right. And so the words and illustrations in the books are not only learning tools, but also cultural products reflecting values of the author. So books are able to communicate the cultural orientation of the author and therefore may also have cognitive consequences for the reader.
Yeah. Wow. Good interpretation.
Hey, thanks. I'm really connected to this, clearly.
Yeah. So in Native Americans' children's books, animals and plants are commonly given names and are prominent characters. And this reflects the importance of nature in their culture and how they see themselves as very much interconnected with their environment. Whereas in non-Native American books, authors don't tend to do this so much, which may reflect how nature and the environment is seen in Western society. You know, it's something we sometimes exploit.
Oh man, that makes total sense. But I think this is a topic that many people might overlook, like you mentioned before. Our understanding of the world can be embedded within storybooks and can influence a young child's scientific thinking.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to want to communicate our own type of culture.
I agree.
But it's something that we want to keep in mind, that we might only be exposing our children to one worldview and actually neglecting to show them how other people see the world.
Exactly. I think that's such a good point. And I think, you know, I don't have children, but if I did, you know, I can imagine wanting to expose them to multiple viewpoints, right? But it's something that, it's like you said, I don't even think we consciously expose them to only our own. it's just something we don't really think about. So maybe being aware of this allows us to have more of an open mind and remember, oh, maybe I should buy this book by this particular author because it gives them this viewpoint versus this author, which would be this viewpoint.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily just within books as well. Books is just the example. This is actually something that we can extend to many other issues. So you can imagine that a child is a product of its environment. And that environment is not just where the child grows up. It's who the child spends time with. It's who the parents spend time with, where the child is educated, among many, many, many other factors.
No, you're exactly right, though. It does expand beyond books. It's really just in our everyday lives and what we're exposed to.
Definitely.
On a day-to-day basis. And if we're aware, you know, that we want to increase our exposure, then we likely will. This week on The Science Line, we are joined by graduate student James Paris, who studies stream ecology here at Idaho State with Dr. Colden Baxter.
Yeah, so James, Risa and I were just talking about the subtle differences in how nature is portrayed in Native American versus non-Native American books. So am I right in thinking that some of your research is with the Shoshone-Bannock tribes?
It is, yeah. It's been a collaborative effort focused on the Fort Hall Reservation.
So what is it that you actually do there?
So what we are looking at is just trying to understand the web of life that occurs on the Snake River floodplain. The overall aim of the project is just trying to understand basically what fish are eating, because tribal members have a invested interest in fishing. A lot of tribal members will rely on trout that they catch on the bottoms for food.
Oh, great.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we're excited to hear more about that as we get into today's program. But first on the science line, we like to start out by finding out if our guest was well-behaved in school and if you ever had to write lines on the board.
I don't think I did, but I, yeah. I remember sitting in a dark room once and having to write, I guess maybe I did have to write lines.
Oh, really? Okay. A dark room?
It was a dark room alone. I had a piece of paper, and I think it was maybe more of like a reflection of...
Oh, self-reflection of what
you did. Yeah, it's like, you don't think about what you did.
Oh, that was so much worse than being told.
That's almost worse than lines.
It is. Yeah. Oh, that is.
Yeah, so I guess, I did not write lines.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, man.
So the reason we always start off with that is because based on how well you're able to communicate your science throughout the show, the idea of the show is that we're going to give you a certain number of lines at the end. So the better you do, the less lines you get. So that's the incentive.
Yeah, and so you need to remember your line. Your line is, I will prove that stream ecology is the best type of biology today on the show.
Okay.
Do you even believe that to be true?
I do.
Okay, well, that's good.
Well, I'm not sure I do because I'm a microbiologist, right? And it may be the smallest science, but I think it's the mightiest. So you have a lot of proving to do today.
All right, then. So without any further ado, I think we should jump straight into our first segment, which is the Why Do We Care segment. So this is when we give you 2 minutes to explain to our listeners what you do as a scientist and why they should care.
So, yeah, what I study is the flow of energy through organisms that live on river floodplains. And river floodplains are just low-lying areas adjacent to rivers or streams where the water can overflow. And there's a whole lot of cool stuff that goes on when that happens because water moves sediment around. It dictates where plants can grow, and it also allows organisms to move. So it overall creates this very messy patchwork of different environments and habitats then are occupied by different organisms, ranging from microbes all the way up to fish. And of course, it's a very transitionary ecosystem because where water and land ends is very difficult sometimes to discern. But that's all to say that basically the idea of my research is looking at how this messy landscape then controls ecological processes, including energy flow. I study food webs, which are the connections that organisms make with one another by eating each other. And these food webs are important because they not only sustain the organisms of interest, like trout or birds or things that people sort of have aesthetic value or even cultural or subsistence value, but also these food webs can act to stabilize populations of organisms. So it's kind of like the more intact a food web is, the more unlikely it is that organisms might disappear from the landscape because they're sort of all interdependent on one another.
I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Our guest today is sixth year PhD student James Paris, who studies in Idaho State University's Stream Ecology Lab under the guidance of Professor Colden Baxter. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us for questions and trivia on the Science Line.
KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
We want to pause for a moment to let you know that you're listening to The Science Line. I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Now we're going to jump back into our conversation with PhD student in the Department of Biological Sciences, James Paris. So James, I know that your work has a lot to do with measuring the flow of energy through aquatic food webs. Can you explain to us what a food web is and how energy can flow through it?
Yeah, I want to know what the heck that means.
So in a basic sense, a food web is just a map of all the different interactions that are occurring between different organisms in any kind of habitat that allows us to understand the ways in which organisms interact with each other, namely through what they're consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's a who eats whom.
Who eats whom, yes, exactly. Yeah. Anytime, of course, an organism eats something, it's deriving energy from that prey resource.
Okay.
And there are measurements that can be made that allow us to track the energy as it moves between organisms.
How do you track that?
There are a lot of ways. The way that I do it, mostly based on measuring gut contents of animals, especially fish.
Ooh.
In my research.
So I've been by your lab. I remember that you guys were pumping water, or you've got these devices that you can use to pump water into fish's stomachs to mm-hmm. get them to throw up their stomach contents?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's how you do it?
Yeah. When working with trout, especially, and other fishes that have actual stomachs, what you can do is use a variety of different tools. We often just use very high-tech approach, which is just a weed sprayer, pressurized weed sprayer. And you send a pressurized stream of water into the fish's mouth. It hits the back of their stomach where they have kind of a muscular sphincter that holds it closed, and it flushes everything back out through their mouth.
Risa, you're losing it over there.
Oh my gosh. So clearly I work with bacteria because this is blowing my mind. Okay, once you have gotten them to throw up, essentially, how do you identify the actual food contents?
Well, that is, oh man, that is.
There's tears.
There are a lot of tears involved with that. What we do is generally take all that material, the barf, back to the lab, and then identify different bugs or fish or other bits of food stuff under the microscope.
So backtracking a little bit to your food web stuff, I know a lot of people will have learned about trophic levels in high mm-hmm. school, which is basically what eats what and mm-hmm. who's the apex and what's the producer at the very bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So how is a food web different to a trophic pyramid?
That's a great question. So food webs, they kind of break apart the trophic level idea because there are a lot of organisms that feed at different trophic levels, say omnivores. If you, in a strict trophic level sense, they would be feeding at like a consumer level by eating other animals, mm-hmm. but then at a basal resource level when they eat plants or detritus or decomposing stuff. So there are these specific types of organisms that, again, kind of blur the lines between these different trophic levels.
So basically you're saying it's the more complicated reality that we see
exactly.
rather than this oversimplistic mm-hmm. triangle that mm-hmm. we like to try and sort of construct the world within.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. That's right. Good to know.
So what are the broader implications as you study these food webs?
So within food webs, there might be animals or organisms that have or that are important to people. Say trout, cutthroat trout, or rainbow trout,
okay.
fish that people like to angle for and mm-hmm. like to eat. And there are groups of peoples, even in our region, that
will consume these fish for basic subsistence. But also food webs, they provide a more mechanistic understanding of ecosystems. What we can do is look at kind of broader health of an ecosystem through food webs. And if you manipulate one aspect of an ecosystem, say in a floodplain, through changes in flooding or water patterns of water flow, then you can see where in the food webs different changes occur and how those changes kind of ripple out through the food web.
So I had a bit of a realization yesterday, and I'm glad it sort of happened right before you came on, because I went fishing on the Snake River. And I guess to preface this, when I first came to ISU, I was so confused as to why there were so many stream ecologists in the biology department, because the biology department is really dominated by people interested in streams and fishes. But then I was at the Snake River yesterday, and in the 2 hours that I was there, I saw a beaver in the wild for the first time. Mm. I saw ospreys hunting on the waterway. I saw trout. Luckily, I caught one.
Right on.
And I sort of thought, well, wow, there's actually such a complex web of life that exists around the water here in Idaho, because we have a lack of it in other areas. So I wonder if you could speak to why you think that rivers and lakes and water in Idaho is such a hub for biodiversity.
One of the reasons that first comes to mind is, so you're on the Snake
River?
Yeah. So an aspect of my research deals with how complex landscapes lead to different food web patterns or patterns in biodiversity that ultimately make them kind of hotspots for life. And so the Snake River, even though it's the Snake River through our region here, just north of Pocatello, even though it's a serious blue-collar working river, it's used for agricultural irrigation and for a little bit for power production. It's still, in a lot of stretches, pretty physically complex. There's a lot of different habitat types occurring, like off-channel, side channels, or big gravel bars with islands and patches of different riparian forest. And so all of this patchiness creates an arena for all these different organisms to occur and interact.
So it's that diversity of niches which allows there to be so many different species, as opposed to other landscapes which are more homogeneous and therefore only are inhabited by...
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, and a lot of human-altered landscapes do become homogenized and kind of lose that diversity and diversity of habitat and diversity of niche space. But there's more research coming out, and some of it was even done by a former graduate student in the stream ecology lab that showed that also, in addition to sort of just having more niche space across a complex landscape, these diversity of habitat types and the way that they come together at the scale of a, say, like a whole river floodplain, they actually influence the ways that organisms interact. So they also create this, they sort of mediate different feeding interactions among organisms too. So in a way, it's like the complexity is interacting with organismal interactions themselves and kind of creating this web of coexistence, if that makes sense.
So it's almost like, I guess if a layperson is thinking about it, you've got all these different habitats that exist within the wider river habitat. Mm-hmm. So you've got the animals in the pools and riffles interacting with those in the log jams and the log jam animals interacting with the birds that fly overhead and all that.
Absolutely.
Sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So as a stream ecologist, what are the challenges for managing Idaho's water resources? And am I right in thinking that agriculture uses a lot of water and doesn't leave much for nature?
Yeah. So agriculture is one of the main barriers to healthy river ecosystems in Idaho. And it is true that the way that water is currently managed, there isn't a lot of water left over for these dynamic processes to occur.
Because we're extracting it for irrigation.
For other purposes.
Yeah. And not only are we extracting it and moving the water elsewhere, especially to then water crops, but also the act of storing it behind dams and releasing it at times of the year that's more unnatural.
Oh.
We're changing the regime of flow.
Mm-hmm.
So normally in our region, we would have a lot of spring runoff. So there'd be kind of a classic flood pulse that would move through the Snake River, for example, around this time. But that pulse and flow is generally dampened because upstream of here, there are a series of dams that are storing the water for use later in the summer when things get hotter and drier.
Mm.
So it's, yeah, the amount of water is changing, but also the timing of the delivery.
Sure.
To yeah. Ecosystems and people have changed too.
Interesting. So to change directions a little bit, we've read that your research works with many other scientists and state and federal agencies and even the Shoshone-Bannock tribes. And we wondered how you go about communicating your research with those different groups. Do you tailor your communication strategies to suit a particular audience?
It's something I try to do, and it's something I've become more aware of. One kind of example that I've learned when it comes to how scientific language is used and how it can be interpreted. I was on a field trip leading some tribal middle schoolers on our study sites, and in standard ecological lexicon or language, we talk about native versus non-native species. And I use something like, I said, oh yeah, and this fish is non-native. And one of the kids said, oh, you mean like a colonizer? And so I was like, wow, yeah. So the ways that we talk about science is even kind of embedded in our own
culture.
Yes.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, thanks for sharing that story.
Risa, we should definitely move on to trivia.
Yeah, this is the most important part of the show.
Absolutely.
Okay, I will kick the trivia off, Scott.
Very good.
And I will ask James, what is the longest river in the world?
Man, okay. I think I'm going to say the Amazon.
The longest river in the world is officially the Nile.
Oh, that's a bummer.
And the Nile is about 4,000 miles long, and it originates in Central Africa, and its mouth empties into the Mediterranean. However, here you go, James, it could be the Amazon River, because there's actually some controversy about where the actual mouth of the Amazon River is, and so it's not agreed upon.
Oh.
So you get it right.
You get it right.
All right, this should be an easier one. What is Idaho's state fish? And for an extra point, what is Idaho's state animal?
Okay, so the state fish, I'm pretty sure, is cutthroat.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Ding, ding, ding.
State animal.
But the bonus point.
Is it... I know the state bird is mountain bluebird.
Mm-hmm.
Is that...
I think that's right.
Okay.
But it's not the state animal.
Okay.
Apparently, the Appaloosa horse is the Idaho state animal. Did I say that right? Maybe.
You did.
Okay, fine.
I'm not familiar with them, though.
Okay.
No, don't know. Don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
Great research.
I was going to say cow, but because I see a lot of cows.
A lot of cows. That makes more sense to me. I don't know what an Appaloosa horse is, and I'm sure there's some Idahoans going, oh my goodness.
All right.
You guys do not know your state history. Okay. So, James, do you know how, speaking of cutthroat trout, our state fish, how did those fish get their name?
They have a pretty distinctive red slash mark under their jawbones.
Mm-hmm. He knows his stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So it just looks like they've had the net slit, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Savage.
He's had to make so many of them throw up.
Yeah.
Slit mark a lot.
True.
All right. Here is our last question for you. How can you tell how old a fish is?
I think there are a couple ways. You can either look at scales, or they have a little ear bone called an otolith.
Absolutely. Wow. This is, we are two methods, right?
Yeah.
I've done some scale analysis. I haven't looked at otoliths, but it's kind of like tree ring analysis. You look at the accretion of material over time, and you can see definitive layers generally, or rings.
That's really neat. Do you know how you do the ear bones?
It's like some pretty serious surgery where you have to go...
Kind
of dig into the back of a fish skull and pull out something the size of a little speck of gravel or even smaller.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then then you blow it up with lasers, I think. I don't really know what happens after that. But
wow.
I think you can look at it under a microscope. I don't think you have to blow it up.
That sounds cool.
It
might make someone want to be a fishy.
Okay, now we've disintegrated this bone with a laser. What do we do? No, we meant make it bigger. Okay. All right, James, for your final trivia question, what is the fastest fish in the world?
Marlin.
Yes, wow. You're absolutely right. You almost second-guessed yourself. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The black marlin can swim at speeds of up to 80 miles an hour, and the largest one ever caught was 15.3 feet and weighed 1,650 pounds.
Wow.
Which is really big.
Well, we have reached that time where we have to assign some lines to James based on how well he communicated his science. James, do you remember your line?
I don't think so.
Your line, James, was that I will prove that stream ecology is the best type of biology. And of course, Risa thinks that it isn't because she's a microbiologist.
That's right.
But small but mighty.
But he came pretty close.
Yeah, I think you did pretty damn well. So we were thinking about giving you a line for every mile of the Snake River, which is 1,078 miles. But we thought that was pretty harsh. So we thought we'd just give you one line for every mile of the Portneuf River, which is 124 miles.
That's a lot more manageable. I appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem. We know you're working on your dissertation right now, so we thought we don't want to impact on that too much.
That's right. Yeah,
just
he's
a little
getting
bit.
Ready to finish up.
Yeah,
exactly. So we have to be a little easier.
I'll include that in the appendix of the dissertation.
I'd like to, in the acknowledgement, like to thank the science line for not giving me 1,000 lines. All right, thanks so much for joining us, James.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. Yeah, and thank you to our listeners for joining us today on The Science Line.